But if we take that last year to start with, so somebody who might be in their last year of life might start to notice that their energy levels are dropping, and people might notice that they can sleep for long periods and not really feel refreshed afterwards. Wanting to eat and drink less is very much part of the natural dying process. Some people can become worried and frightened and emotional towards the end of life.
Hello, I'm Hannah, and welcome to the Life and Loss podcast, where we discuss difficult topics including living with life-limiting illnesses, dying, death and bereavement. Today I'm joined by Dr. Amy, lead consultant at Forest Home Hospice. Welcome, Amy.
Hi there, nice to be here.
And in this episode we will discuss the end of life stages and how they differ from person to person. So Amy, first question for you. How might we know or recognise when someone's approaching the end of life?
That's an interesting question. Just let me reflect it back to you, because end of life means different things to different people. So what timings are you meaning by the end of life?
I would say maybe in the final few weeks of someone's life, when the signs maybe become more obvious.
Yeah, okay, yeah, you're right. As healthcare professionals, we often refer to end of life as somebody who's in their last year of life. But that can be quite a difficult time period to define. But if we take that last year to start with, so somebody who might be in their last year of life might start to notice that their energy levels are dropping. They might want to focus on different things. For example, they might not want to carry on work if they've been continuing to work up until then. And they might find that they're having a few more interactions with healthcare professionals, have greater nursing needs and taking more medications. And then in the last few weeks of life, that tiredness and the energy levels dropping might well become more pronounced. And people might notice that they can sleep for long periods and not really feel refreshed afterwards. And then when it comes to the last few days of life, that's a time period where it's a bit easier to define when that time period starts, because there are more definite signs. So people tend to take to bed for that period of time, so they will be looked after in bed all the time. And at times they might, family members, people observing them might notice that they don't seem to be just simply asleep, but actually very hard to wake up. And at those times, people might be slipping in and out of unconsciousness. But that person is very safe and comfortable and just very deeply asleep, so won't be disturbed, won't be woken up. And particularly during those periods when the person is very deeply asleep, people might notice that their breathing pattern changes. And so you might notice little runs of a very rapid, shallow breathing, and then some long pauses in breathing and some deep sighing breaths. And it all sounds a little bit alarming, but if people know what to expect, then it's much, much less alarming. And we know that certainly the person who's experiencing those changes in breathing themselves, if they then have a period where they're a bit more awake and able to interact, they won't ever report being troubled by that breathing. Another thing that we recognise when somebody's in their last few days of life is that they're unable to swallow properly. So actually swallowing is quite a complicated manoeuvre. It involves the coordination of lots of different muscles, if you think about it, and it's from the mouth down into the stomach. There's actually quite a large area of the body that has to be activated. So we recognise that people have problems swallowing at this stage in life, and we tend to give medicines via a different route from oral tablets and liquids. So, for example, we can give people just a little infusion of medicine if they need it, or give medicine via a patch.
And would the medical and the nursing care be different for the person at the end of their life?
Yep. So we know that we only have one chance to get it right. And so if somebody is an inpatient in hospital or in a hospice, we personalise a care plan to somebody in their last days of life. And what that means is that we'll really take the time to find out everything that we need to ensure that that person's end of life is as good as possible. So we really focus on who that person is and what matters to that person and those that are important to them. So we develop a personalised care plan, make sure that we've thought about things like, would the person maybe like to see a chaplain? Do they have particular worries that we might be able to address? Do they have a favourite pet that they'd like to come in and be with them? So really just asking those questions, which aren't necessarily medical, they're just human. And then the nurses follow a regime that just means that there's very regular checks. For example, when somebody is in bed and not moving around, there are increased risk of developing bed sores. And so the nurses will every few hours be prompted with this personalised care plan just to gently move the person in bed and check that they're not getting sore or stiff in bed. So it just means that we're really thinking about everything. And then the care plan does prompt, once that person has died, that the family members are thought of as well into bereavement. And if there's anything specific, then the care plan will pick up on that and make sure that the family members are supported.
And I know in a hospital setting, there's a lot of focus on keeping the patient hydrated, and families often show their love through cooking dinners and providing food for their loved one as a way of showing that they're caring. Mm-hmm. Is that something that someone should be doing as they're approaching end of life?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Food and drink can quite often become a real focus at end of life. And actually, it can often provoke some conflict because, for example, a wife who's been cooking her husband's dinners for the last 50 years, and suddenly the dinners that she's producing aren't being eaten anymore. And some people can almost feel that like they're failing to feed and nurture their loved one, or that they're being rejected in some way. We know that wanting to eat and drink less is very much part of the natural dying process. So we would always encourage families to provide food and to offer small amounts of food and drink, but never to worry if that person doesn't want it, because that's just in keeping with the natural process of their dying. And just to touch on the medical side of that as well, because as you know, when people are in hospital, there's all kinds of things that we can do to feed or hydrate people, involving drips and tubes and things like that. And we know that when somebody is naturally dying, if we try to artificially hydrate them or feed them, that actually the calories and the fluid ends up being burdensome for the body, because the body doesn't need it, and it can actually cause more harm than good. So that's very much part of that personalised care plan that I was talking about, is thinking about what that person needs in terms of hydration and nutrition, and personalise it, and involving the family as well. So if somebody isn't eating and drinking, one thing that family members can get involved in is the provision of what we call mouth care. And that's just a simple process of keeping somebody's mouth clean and hydrated. And so we have some little what we call mouth sponges, which can go into somebody's mouth and for them just to gently clean around teeth and the gums and the lips. And we can actually use a person's favourite drink on the mouth sponge. So it's not unusual to sometimes use things like gin and tonic even maybe. So that's something that a family member who is maybe missing providing meals for someone can get involved in and can bring a lot of comfort.
I hope that you are finding this episode helpful as you navigate through your own grieving journey. Grief is deeply personal and often isolating. If you'd like to share your own thoughts or experiences, please comment below. Okay, so you've spoken really brilliantly about the physical sort of signs. Is there any emotional signs that someone might be dying or any spiritual signs that they might show as well?
Yeah, so everybody's different. Everybody does it in their own individual way. I think that I should speak about the fact that some people can become worried and frightened and emotional towards the end of life. And that's why our multidisciplinary team very much incorporates both support for the family and for the patient in terms of counselling and spiritual support. So it's always something that we would think about. And when somebody is in their last few days of life and things are starting to shut down a little bit, we can see that people find it difficult to get their thoughts in order and they can become a bit muddled and confused, which can cause them to become agitated. And it's very normal. We see this a lot. You might have heard of the term delirium, which is the medical word for it. And all that describes is the natural process of the brain not working so well and beginning to slow down. And the way that we would approach that is that we would look at anything which might be contributing to the delirium. For example, if somebody had an infection that we could treat, then we might do that. If somebody had uncontrolled pain, then we would treat that pain. So we would look at anything which might be making a confusion or an agitation worse. But also we have got medication which can just help people to relax if once we've done everything else that we can do to orientate someone and make them feel secure and comfortable.
And how about their final thoughts or reflections? Do people often become reflective on their life or share regrets with you or with their family about things they wish they'd done?
Well, yeah, definitely I've realised working in palliative care that there's absolutely no such thing as a normal family. And I think that, yeah, it's fairly common for people to reflect on things that have happened throughout their life. And for people want to make amends for things that have happened and see people that they may not have seen for a long time. We often get asked in those final weeks and days about people coming in to say goodbye. And I would always say that if you're thinking about somebody coming to visit who has a specific journey to make, I would always say do that sooner rather than later, whilst that person is more able to have a conversation and if they might have something specific to say to them or something. So I would always say if you're thinking about it, yeah, come down and see them, come and have that conversation.
Yeah. And if someone's caring for somebody at home, are there any alarming signs that within the last sort of 1 to 2 days that people should be aware of? What's normal and what's not normal?
Yeah. Well, again, there's no such thing as completely normal. everybody is unique. We've talked briefly about breathing changes earlier on in the podcast. One of the things that people often worry about, and a term that isn't very nice but you might have heard of, is a death rattle. Mm. A death rattle is something that can happen, but if people know to expect it and know what it is and understand it, then it's not frightening or scary and certainly not distressing for the person who's experiencing it. So a death rattle is caused by the little secretions or phlegm or saliva that we all get at the back of our throat all the time. And if you imagine when you're awake, or even if you're just normally asleep, you kind of clear your throat, cough, swallow those secretions away the whole time. But somebody who's in the last few days of life won't be doing that. And so what is termed as a death rattle is simply the air of the breathing going through those secretions which are in the throat. But the person who's experiencing that won't be aware of them at all. And actually, one thing that a wise doctor once told me is that in some ways that death rattle is reassuring, because it's a sign that the person who's making that noise is really deeply asleep and peaceful and safe. And so although for those people listening it can be a bit disruptive, the person who's experiencing it is very, very comfortable. Another thing that sometimes can be a bit alarming for people caring for somebody, particularly who's dying at home, can be changes in colour, particularly in the what we call the peripheries. So hands and feet can, when the blood supply changes to them and the blood pressure drops a bit, which again is all completely a normal stage of dying, but the hands and the feet or other places of the body can become a bit mottled or dusky in colour and feel cool. And that can be worrying for people, but for the person who's experiencing it, completely untroublesome, and they're safe and they're comfortable. It's very normal.
And I've also heard, just from people speaking about their experiences, that their loved one can sometimes sit up in bed bolt upright or try and get out of the bed. Is that quite common as well?
I wouldn't say it's quite common, but certainly it is recognised. If we go back to the brain slowing down and changing and not processing things as normal, so that the word that I used to describe that was delirium, sometimes instead of becoming more sleepy, people can become more energetic, more active. It is unusual. It often happens in people who are feeling a bit unsettled about something. And as healthcare professionals, we can usually recognise the kind of people that might become a bit more agitated and active in their last few days of life. And the way that we would manage it is just lots of reassurance and orientation, making sure that people who are familiar to them and love to them are around, having familiar music playing. And then if we need to, then we have medication that we can use that can help somebody just feel more comfortable, more peaceful and more relaxed. One thing that families can worry about is that people might be trying to say something to them in their last few days of life, but are unable to articulate things and get their words out properly. That can be really distressing for families. But actually, what we know from our experience is that person is probably, their thoughts are all kind of a bit jumbled up, and they're not specifically trying to say something. They're just not really feeling peaceful and using the techniques that I talked about earlier in terms of reassurance and reorientation, we can normally help that person to feel a lot more relaxed.
And one thing I've always wondered is a lot of nurses, they know when someone's approaching those final sort of 1 to 2 hours and they'll ring the loved ones and call them in to be by the bedside. How do they know that the patient's got to that point?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I've got some personal experience of that with a family member. What I would say is the nurses at Forest Home and palliative care staff generally are very attuned to changes. We've talked about some of the changes in breathing pattern, sometimes in people's colour, just in the terms of how they're responding and how deeply unconscious they are. So sometimes some of those things will change. I know that often it's really important for family members that they are there at the moment of death. And often family members can sit for days and days with the person who is dying, anticipating that it's going to happen any time. And then we see time and time again that the family member pops out to go and have a cup of tea, pops out to have a shower, you know, just does something to look after themselves, which they must do. And the person chooses that moment to die. And actually, in my family, my mother-in-law was dying at the Macmillan unit in Christchurch. And myself and my husband, both doctors, were sitting with her all of the time. And did a little set of medical observations just because we're doctors, because we wanted to know what was going on. So we checked her breathing rate, we checked her pulse, and we checked how much oxygen was in her system just with a little oxygen probe. And everything was completely normal and stable. So we told her that we were just going to nip home for a couple of hours to see the children and a change of clothes and things. And we'd only been gone for 20 minutes and we were called back and she'd died.
Wow.
So that and just all the other observations that I've had whilst working in a hospice definitely tells me that it's not coincidence that people choose to die often when they are alone. Mm. So that leads me to think that it's a deeply personal, private experience. And also just to constantly reassure family members that if they're not there at that moment, it's because that person has chosen to leave on their own.
Yes.
And that's okay. So never feel guilty. You can't be there all the time and you've got to look after yourself as well.
And just for anyone who doesn't know, so the moment of death, would that be when the heart stops beating or there's no longer a pulse?
Yeah, so it's not a dramatic moment at all. In fact, often the way that a death happens at the hospice is a family member will tentatively come out of the room and say to the nursing staff, "We think they've gone, but we're not sure." So what we generally see is that erratic breathing pattern will carry on for a little while, and then at one point there'll be an out-breath and there will be no further in-breath. And then after that, we know that within the body, the heart will soon take its last beat, and then the brain will stop working, and that's when the person has died. At that point, a doctor will come to formally recognise the death, and the way that they do that is they listen to the chest and for 1 minute, just to see whether there's any breath sounds or any heartbeats for that 1 minute. And they will also want to just have a look in a person's eyes, because you can tell by the size of the pupil in the eye whether the brain is still working or not. So that's just the process of the doctors coming in to formally recognise that the death has happened.
Thank you very much, Amy. And thank you for listening to the Life and Loss podcast by Forest Home Hospice Charity. For more information on our work, please visit our website, which is www.foresthomehospice.org.uk. Thank you for listening. If you've been touched by this interview, or if you know someone who could benefit from hearing it, I'd encourage you to like, subscribe, and share this podcast. By spreading the word, you help us reach others living with a life-limiting illness, letting them know that they're not alone.